Summit County Council met yesterday in the studio with a recap of that lengthy agenda. I have County Council Member Roger Armstrong. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the council is spending some time in closed session, some of that I'm guessing to discuss the Oscar Thorpe Ranch conservation. What we have heard was that the council was scheduled to vote on something next week. You think that still will happen?
I don't know. We haven't had that conversation about when or how or mechanicals.
Okay. Let's see. Also yesterday, the county got a mental health and substance abuse strategic effect update from your mental health officer, Aaron Newman, along with Communities of Caring Coordinator Mary Krista Smith. What were the takeaways for you there?
Takeaways. This is one of those real success stories, I think, in terms of a combination of government, nonprofits, and private parties working together to accomplish something. We've got the Communities of Care program that's up and running and doing great things with the kids in Summit County, and that's a partnership where all of the schools in Summit County are working together, the three school districts, with Mary Krista, who's leading the effort, the health department. Our youth are deeply involved in it, and they're achieving great things in terms of, they've got this Safe Utah app where they can report bullying and people struggling in school and get people help. They've been trained in QPR, and that QPR has resulted in several students' lives, I think, being saved, where somebody has recognized that somebody is struggling, has gone through the QPR process to determine that they are suicidal and has gotten them help. So that's a gigantic success. We received some funding for Peace House, the Christian Center, Jewish Family Services, and the People's Health Clinic to have an advanced practice RN who's available for, who can prescribe drugs for people with mental health issues. And that's a huge deal because one of the items that the mental health survey revealed is that drug maintenance, drug management, being able to check in with somebody who's supposed to be taking medication is a real challenge. People have trouble accessing people who can help them manage the drugs that they're supposed to be on. And this helps in a huge way to fill that need.
Yeah, something else the survey had pointed out was that there's just no place for somebody needing to get into treatment to go to. Any discussion about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of that, I think through Valley Behavioral Health and some of our existing resources, we're doing a better job now. We're at least trying to connect, and some of their activities have been great in determining access by identifying people that are practicing in the county that are available to see patients. So I think that's working. I think Valley Behavioral Health is still doing a pretty good job of referring people to providers and providing direct services as well. So I think we're doing a good job with that, a lot better than we were before. And again, I think the messaging about stigma and reducing stigma and letting people know that it's okay to seek mental health treatment if you need it. If you're depressed, talk to somebody, get some help. If you're struggling with drug addiction, we have resources. Contact the health department, and we'll find a way to get you into the system.
Yeah, and I think with the exception of the Communities of Caring program, I mean, I think one of the accomplishments, certainly biggest accomplishment, has just been rounding up all of the resources and what coming under, not that there's a single umbrella, but I guess, you know, the right hand talking to the left hand finally.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not specifically Communities of Care. That's this big Mental Health Alliance program that's been working now for a year, year and a half. And they've got a big agenda, and every month they meet with their board to check off the items that they've accomplished. They're well ahead on some items, they're on schedule on others, and there are a few others that they need to raise the bar a little bit. But it's a massive effort, and right now it's looking like a really terrific success story. We're about to go out with a new RFP. Our current relationship with Valley Behavioral Health, I think, expires at the end of next year. So we're preparing an RFP to go out and see what comes into the community in terms of what kind of providers are out there to provide services. And it's an opportunity for us as part of that RFP process to really be more specific about what we want out of that provider and to identify the services and dovetail that back with this general mental health plan that we have to file with the state every year. And I'm excited about that process because I think we can do better.
So behavioral health, and they serve as the county's what? Go-to mental health resource?
Yeah, they do everything from assisting us with the jail, doing assessments in the jail, to actually doing counseling. You know, the county is responsible for providing certain mental health services to its population. We don't have internally the staff to do that, so we contract that out to Valley Behavioral Health, and that's been a relationship that we've had since before I've been on the council. So it's now that we've got this effort up and running, now that we've been able to determine through the survey where the real needs are, where the holes are, and this big effort has started to shape things, this provides us with a new opportunity to bring in a provider that can not only provide services directly, but that we can link up with the various public-private partnerships that we have in this area.
All right. Also, a discussion with regard to specifically budget revenues. Anything of note there?
Yeah, I think the things that, you know, I think Matt Levitt's job is to try and terrify us as much as possible every year before. First, he starts by telling us how, you know, we need to spend more money on certain things, and then he starts telling us about where revenues are falling off, and revenues are falling in certain areas. Building permits are down through August of this year, which is interesting. You know, my response to that was a bit of disbelief because it seems like there's a lot of building going on. We see things happening at the canyons. I know there's a lot happening out in Promontory, and I think, you know, every place we drive, we seem to see another building popping up someplace. Some of those permits were pulled last year, and that may be part of the downturn for this year. But it looks a little bit lighter than it has been. I mean, it's substantially lighter through August. We'll see what happens as the last 4 months of the year fills in. So that's, you know, a fairly significant part of our revenue. Assessing and collecting is another area where we've seen a downturn, and some of that relates to centrally assessed properties, which is a tax that whenever pipelines or, you know, utility systems run through multiple counties, rather than each county assessing an amount on that and creating a little bit of an economic mess for that pipeline operator, the state comes up with an assessment based on revenues and whatever their formula is. And they tell the operator to pay a certain amount, and then that gets distributed out to the counties. And there have been a lot of appeals lately, and they've changed the process for contesting appeals. So if you're a pipeline operator and you don't like the tax that they levied, you can appeal it to the tax commission. And then the counties have to go through multiple hoops to oppose whatever the appeal is and try and resist it. Lately, it seems that the tax commission has been siding with the pipelines and utility companies and coming up with a lowered fee. And then it winds up in a system subject to further appeals. And we can't seem to get letters that allow us to pursue the money that we're owed. So a lot of that money is going uncollected. And it's similar to stuff you and I have talked about before relating to the nightly rental companies, that we know some of those taxes are being collected or should be collected, and we can't access that. We can't get the tax commission to allow us to pursue it. So there's significant revenue there that is not coming in. And then I think the Justice Court, for whatever reason, fines are also declining there. So we're seeing some downturn in revenues. It's not, you know, 50% of our budget, but it's still money.
So how do we make that up?
I don't know the answer to it. You know, I don't know that we can increase fines. I think we will try and find ways to push. I would like to find ways to push the tax commission to allow us to collect the taxes that we're due. That seems like low-hanging fruit, and there doesn't seem to be a justifiable reason to deny that to counties. So I think we need to explore that, and I know we've had discussions with UAC about those kinds of issues. So we'll do what we can.
With the news last week, the county manager, Tom Fisher, isn't recommending any money for nonprofit organizations other than the Children's Justice Center for the next budget year. What response, if any, have you had?
Well, I think people are concerned. You know, part of the problem is when it comes to grants and when it comes to continual grants, what tends to happen is nonprofits budget those grants because they're used to receiving them, they assume they're going to get them, and they include them in their budgets. So I think that there's been some alarm. I think there's been some understanding also by the nonprofits, and I don't know that there's a consensus on the council. We haven't had that discussion yet. That's Tom's recommendation, and I think it was Tom's way of flagging for the nonprofits, here's what I'm going to recommend. You may need to consider your budgets on a going forward basis just in case that money is not available.
Yeah. So is it just for 1 year? I mean, or did Tom just pull off the bandage here and just plans to do away with those grants from here on out?
Like I said, we haven't had the discussion. You know, pointing to the Children's Justice Center, that's a harder one for me because we did make a contribution to that. That contribution benefits the county specifically. So I struggle with that, with regarding that as a pure gift to a nonprofit. We're assisting with the purchase of a building that is going to benefit a county program through the county attorney's office. So I suspect you'll hear more about that as my part of that discussion as it goes forward.
Okay. Let's see. Any concerns with the proposed rental policies that you reviewed for the new Ledges Event Center?
I don't think so. I think it's, you know, what gave me comfort is that it appears that staff did a survey of what the rental rates are for other facilities around the county. One comparison, probably a pretty good one, is the Red Barn in Oakley. That's a new facility that they built 4 or 5 years ago. It's a very nice facility, and I know they get a lot of use out of it. And apparently we're competitive with those rates. So it seems reasonable. I don't know if you've seen the Ledges Center, but it really came out nice. And it'll be a great place for people to have various kinds of events.
All right. The joint meeting with BOSAC, the Snyderville Basin Open Space Advisory Committee, any specific thing come out of that?
I think not any specific. It was a broad range discussion. I think BOSAC is looking for direction. I think the Osgathorpe property probably teed up some of the questions about what are we looking for? What can our sources of funding purchase? And so it was really a conversation about what monies do we have? What criteria do we have for spending those monies? The BOSAC, maybe 3 years ago, developed kind of a grid for evaluating properties. You know, does it have recreational amenities? Does it have, is there something about the near area that makes it really something we want to protect for some specific reason? Does it assist us with some of the challenges we have with connectivity, with transportation, with other things? Does it connect up with other existing amenities so that it enhances those? There are a number of things in that grid. So we had some discussions about those. And, you know, the ranking system, how to do that. I think it was just a useful discussion to sort of help clarify for them to kind of verify that they're going in the right direction. They're proposing to make a few tweaks to some of that, and I think those are probably fine. Our sources of funding really are limited to recreation because Snyderville Basin Rec is the source of that bond funding. It's got to tie back into their mission, which is recreation. And then we've had some discussions as to whether or not TRT funding might be able to be used for purchases of open space. And again, it's got to have a tourist component to it, and that's typically going to be recreation. My example last night might be, you know, if we had a butterfly refuge that we wanted to protect that doesn't necessarily have recreation but could enhance tourism, we could do something like that.
Let's see, another public meeting on the Utah State Roadless Rule Petition and approval of recommendations. So what did you guys do?
The council voted to approve staff's recommendation on that, which is to kind of divide the two areas of roadless rule that staff developed, one to keep primitive essentially the way it is now, and the other to make a restoration area. And the single biggest issue with all of this has to do with two things, the wildland-urban interface and the danger that wildfire presents to properties. And the other is our watershed. And if you, I did some research before we addressed this matter yesterday, and water quality suffers drastically in the event of major wildfires. You get sludge, you get silt, you get a lot of runoff that can contribute to problems with reservoirs, fisheries, streams, rivers, and our watersheds are precious. Our watersheds in Summit County feed the Wasatch Front as well as residents of Summit County. So we've got to make sure that they're protected. I think for me personally, I think I differed slightly from my colleagues, this feels like something a little bit different, this being proposed by the governor's office. I think my colleagues fell out that we need to address the ability of the Forest Service and others, commercial companies, to assist the Forest Service with tree thinning. I mean, that's part of this. We need to take out some of the deadfall, and in some cases, to contribute to spacing among living trees is the right way to do forest management. And I think that they believe that at least teeing that up is worthwhile. My problem with the process is it's a very rushed process. There doesn't seem to be much planning or science behind it, much specificity. I think the belief by the council is that that will be part of the NEPA process with the USDA and the Forest Service as they go through trying to figure out how they're going to implement it if they decide to.
You received a letter from Carl Fisher, executive director of Save Our Canyons, asking you to halt the petition and to forge a plan to deal with the problems plaguing our forests, regardless of the protective designation. So the fact that you voted, you didn't listen to what he had asked?
We certainly discussed it, and Carl was there last night. Carl actually presented his case. Peter Gatch was also there, and he presented, you know, his own research. And again, I think those are consistent, and I don't know that we contest the underlying issue of protecting our forests. Again, I think that the problem is we know that there are millions of trees that are dead. There are millions of trees that are dying. There's deadfall out there. There are massive amounts of fuel. We've seen what happens with wildfires in California without the ability to manage. And then the question is, you know, how do you approach that? And council felt to, you know, send up our recommendation, which doesn't dovetail, I think, perfectly with the governor's recommendation or PLIPCO's. I don't think it's completely inconsistent with it either. They felt that that was the right direction. And I think that, you know, for me, I absolutely understand their desire to do so. I just think that I'd like to see it cooked a little bit more, less rushed.
Was the vote unanimous then, or did you vote against
it? No, it was, I don't know that it was even a vote. It was, staff is instructed to go forward with it.
All right. Finally, I wanted to ask you about the joint meeting with the Basin Planning Commission. Any news out of that? I know that you were looking at a couple of issues, how we move forward with these mixed-use developments, and then whether or not we get rid of the specially planned area.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's always good to have the check-in. We have our quarterly meeting with the Planning Commission and our quarterly meeting with BOSAC about once a year, I think. And this is an opportunity to check in. One's an issue of, do we retain the concept of, and this all relates to the Planning Commission's redraft of the development code, the Snyder Basin Development Code. And one of the issues is, do we retain the SPA, or do we come up with a master plan development concept similar to what we adopted in Eastern Summit County, which is, you know, instead of a negotiated document where you might get additional density, which happens under a SPA, a master plan development where you take the developer's proposal and the existing density on the parcel and start the discussion from there with no additional density attached to it. Although there are, in what was proposed to us, there may be some incentives for additional density if it solves some problems, and we've seen that in a number of deals that we've done. So I think our take on that was it's certainly worth pursuing, and we like the idea of an MPD more than we like a SPA, I think. The other was the, as you said, the, you know, this mixed use kind of zone in various places. And I think they're going to work that up. It's too soon to tell what that would look like. The devil's going to be in the details there. It might address issues of affordable housing. One of my comments to Pat Putt last night was, this feels like an opportunity to address what Pat has always regarded as nodal development, where you've got transportation, you've got small commercial, you've got neighborhoods, where it creates a sticky location that people can get most of their services and goods in one place without having to travel distances to get there. So instead of a promontory having to drive all the way to Smith's and then back to promontory to get groceries, you would have a neighborhood set of facilities close by, possibly a little bit more dense housing for workforce with access to transportation to avoid cars. But again, the devil's in the details, because the last thing we want to do is throw gas on the growth issue and build something that was unintended.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
That's it.
All right. Roger, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
Summit County Council Member Roger Armstrong's. It's a local news hour. Well, the Egyptian Theater presents the Still Drivers Band tonight through Saturday. On the phone with me, the founder of the band and fiddle player, Tammy Rogers. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing great. So thanks. Tell us a little bit about Still Drivers.
Well, we are banned from Nashville, Tennessee. And to be honest, I don't exactly know how to describe us. We've been described so many different ways. we play traditional instruments, meaning we look like a five-piece bluegrass band with upright bass, acoustic guitar, banjo, fiddle, and mandolin, but we don't play traditional bluegrass-sounding music. We're more like, I guess, a singer-songwriter band in that we write all of our own music. We don't do the standard old Bill Monroe, Lester Flatt, Earl Scruggs bluegrass catalog. And we definitely draw from a lot of Southern musical styles, not just Appalachian mountain music. We really all love blues and soul music and R&B music. So you'll definitely hear all of those Southern music styles represented in what we do. We just choose to play them on traditional instruments.
Yeah. So you guys have been together for a while then, huh?
We have. Actually, we got together as a very casual jam session back in the late summer, early fall of 2005. And, it felt like lightning in a bottle. Something really unique happened in the room, and we all enjoyed it so much that we just kind of kept casually getting together for 6 months or so, and finally did a live show there outside of Nashville. All of us had been in the music business for a very long time at that point, so we kind of knew that if we booked a show in Nashville that people would show up. Just out of curiosity and because we all knew so many different people. So we chose to kind of try to fly under the radar for a little while and booked a gig down in Franklin, Tennessee, which is, 20 miles away, and kind of gradually got our chops together that way before we ever did anything in Nashville. And when it did, it kind of made a pretty big splash, and the first record came out in January of 2008. So on the one hand, we've kind of been together about 13 years, but on the other hand, as far as a national, exposure, about 10 years now.
So 2016, you received a Best Bluegrass Album Grammy Award for the album The Muscle Shoals Recording. So tell me about that. And the reason I ask is because there was a Sundance documentary about Muscle Shoals few years ago, and it was something I hadn't been aware of, but it's like one of those studios that just has its own sound.
Oh my goodness, it's just such an amazing historic, because people are coming and still making vibrant music there. I don't know what it is. It's odd that this little tiny town in northern Alabama would host the Rolling Stones and Aretha Franklin and all these great musicians and writers and artists. Our lead singer at the time, Gary Nichols, was born and raised and always lived in Muscle Shoals the whole time he was in the band. So when it came time to make the record, we just felt, I don't know whether it just was time to really put the ball in his court, but we went down to Muscle Shoals and made the record, and it was wonderful. It was a great experience. We all loved it, loved being down there, just kind of a little bit more of a chill vibe, and I think the record reflects that, and really it was a great time, and obviously it worked well to put that record out. It's been our most successful one to date. I mean, we'd had Grammy nominations before, but had not won. So to finally be able to bring home the hardware, as we say, was a great thing.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got three shows tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday, all shows starting at 8 o'clock at the Egyptian Theater. Right. So we've got, let's see, tickets, $29 for Thursday night. They go up to $35 for Friday and Saturday. And people can find out more by parkcityshows.com. I'm going to take it out with one of your songs here. And have a great show in Park City. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. We are so excited to be here. It feels like a, you know, a little bit of a vacation for us to be in one spot for three nights. We're really excited about it.
Okay. Thanks, Tammy.
All right, Leslie.
Well, Jacqueline Knapp is Park City School District's new special education director. She started August 1st. She joins me now in the studio to talk about her new job. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So my understanding is that you came from Weber State University, where you were a psychology professor. Tell us a little bit more about your background and why you wanted the job here in Park City.
Sure. You know, I've always been in special education. I started out, as most of us do, as a paraprofessional. In college, I worked with children who had severe autism doing ABA. Moving on, I've worked for the university, I've consulted for the State Office of Education, I've worked doing educational consultation in private practice, and came from a charter co-op where I was helping to reorganize that special education program. So I've had my feet wet in pretty much all areas that encompass special education.
Yeah, so why Park City for you?
You know what I love about Park City? When you have seven schools and a really involved community and an association like the Ed Foundation, really the sky is the limit in terms of what we can do to help our kids here. So I love that.
Yeah. What percentage of Park City students fall into that special ed designation?
We have about 345 students. You know, that includes our speech students, so some of those filter out in the next couple of years. So it's a little bit hard to say, but generally about 10%.
Yeah. Has there been an uptick in designations? I mean, you just started, so you wouldn't know, but you've looked at it, I'm sure, at some of the records.
Actually, I do know. I'm watching that closely because we want to make sure that we're not overqualifying minority students. We're not overqualifying students who are learning disabled, that they're getting appropriate instruction. So I'm seeing the numbers currently hold true to what they should be on the state level. Our minority classifications are not out of hand. Our numbers are where they should be. And I watch those monthly to make sure we don't over exceed what we should.
Yeah. And I think it's obvious to some of us, you know, that a special ed student, you know, maybe with some cerebral palsy or obvious developmental disabilities. But there are lots of other kids, I mean, on the outside, just look perfectly normal, yet have the special ed designation. I mean, how are they identified?
So this is a process of child find, and this gets a little bit tricky. It starts at a global level in the school where we're giving everybody good instruction. We identify at-risk groups, and there's an uncomfortable conversation, which is sometimes we have kiddos who just need support all the way through school, but they're not necessarily special education. So it's this really fine balance sometimes, and that's looked at through historical information as they grow. We keep good records. We look at intervention trends. And at the point where they're just not able to make it themselves, that's when we would want to begin to start to serve them.
So are most kids identified early for special ed, or does it come later in some cases?
Some of them are identified early. Our kiddos with genetic disorders, Down syndrome, autism, relatively easy to watch. But the others, the good news is in Park City School District, you have a phenomenal K-3 literacy program where they receive intensive interventions. And by the time they're coming out of that, We have a really good track record to know. So those invisible disabilities can be tricky, but we want to let students stay in that least restrictive environment as long as possible. And so it's just about ethics, it's about watching, it's about monitoring and keeping good pace with those students.
So what do you mean by a restrictive environment?
Every time we take a child out of a classroom or pull them out because they're at risk or they need specialized instruction, that's restricting their environment. And there's a long history of federal law to show that we need to let them be with their peers as long as possible and take them out as little as possible. And that's always a balance we work with.
Yeah. A special ed audit was done in the school district a few years ago. No surprise at the time that we had some work to do. I'm guessing you're familiar with that audit and its findings?
Yes, I've read the letters from the State Office of Education. It specifically addressed minority qualifications. Last year, those new numbers moved back into line, and I'm getting monthly reports from our stats genius, Caitlin, to keep them back where they should be. This is just, you know, this is always a difficult area. I'm going to be honest about that, and so these are qualifications we watch vigilantly. I go through files. I attend team meetings. So we just need to make sure the data is there and we're being fair to all of our populations.
So we've made some good progress then addressing those issues?
Yep, that's right. They're currently in line and we're going to keep them there.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the special ed designations. We've got what are known as 504s, IEPs. Are there more than that?
So we generally see special ed law and plans as a 504 and IEP. One of the things that's been hard in the community is the community has felt like they've had a lack of communication from special education. So we have a website now. If you go on the FAQ section, you'll see it gives you a big explanation of the difference between the two. It will tell you the point of contact you can go to in your school if you have a question. And also if your child does have a 504, which are specific accommodations, versus an IEP, which is specialized instruction or being pulled out of the classroom. There's information about longitudinally how you will help your student, for example, extended time on the SAT and the ACT. That's now also on our website. So we're trying to get that information more accessible.
Yeah. And looking through the website this morning, I think I counted like a staff of 35. That seemed big for when we're talking about, what, 350 kids?
We actually have 20 special education teachers, and we have about 40 paraprofessionals, so we have some of the paras on the site. Given our, and I'll tell you why it's good that there are a lot of professionals, because that means a really low student-to-teacher ratio, the lowest I've ever seen in the state.
It's expensive.
It is.
Yeah.
It is expensive. The good news is I believe we're utilizing our resources wisely. We train well. Our teachers are right on pace with the district initiatives, with Wilson programming and other things, and our kids are getting good services. Also, people don't realize that we can help serve that at-risk general ed population as well. So it's not strictly special ed instruction.
Yeah. So does the special ed, they're in all of the schools?
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like you've got your own department and you reach out to the different schools. You're within the schools.
Correct.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit. I understand that you went to the University of Utah Reading Clinic for some intensive training in that Wilson reading system.
That's right. So our special education, the district went to a K-3 intensive early literacy program, and this has been talked about at length. When I came into the district, our staff, you know, were trained in a number of methods, but we want to make sure we are innovative and using really specific methodology that's good for our students. And so we are moving to align vertically with the district in that. And so our teachers are now going to the Wilson training in addition to the other things that we do.
Yeah. Why is it so effective with special ed kids specifically?
The good thing about the Wilson program is that it's really comprehensive. It starts them right at the beginning and makes sure there is no gaps as they go along. So for our kiddos, it can move at a slower pace. And for regular education students, it can go at the pace that's appropriate.
Okay. And again, you've on the website, you've got the facts that parents and caregivers can go on and find out a lot more.
Right.
Yeah. Anything else you wanted to mention, Jacqueline?
No, it's nice to be here with you today. And you know, special education is accessible. People are welcome to call my office. There's the website. We have a point of contact in every building, and we want to make sure that all of our children with disabilities are served appropriately.
Okay. Thanks for your time this morning. It's Jacqueline Knapp, the Park City School District's new special education director. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, with their ballots in their hands, Wasatch County residents have the opportunity to vote on a $10 million bond for open space for Wasatch County. Heidi Franco is the chair of the Wasatch Open Lands Committee. She's also a member of the Heber City Council. She joins me now on the phone to talk about why she would like Wasatch County residents to vote yes on that issue. And next week, we'll be talking with a representative who's against the bond. But good morning to you, Heidi. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Leslie. Appreciate your time.
The bond is for $10 million, but the way I understand it, only the first $5 million can be spent. Talk to me a little bit about how that bond is structured.
Oh, very good. Very good. Yes, the total is $10 million, but the County Council, in conjunction with the Wasatch Open Lands Board, has decided that, first of all, it's going to take at least, well, let me put this in chronological order. If the bond can pass this next month, then it would take another year for open space projects to be developed and meet all of the criteria, and then those projects would be presented to the Wasatch County Council. So over the next year, that would be the priority for the Open Lands Board in getting ready to use the bond money, but it wouldn't be withdrawn yet. And so over the next year, those projects would be proposed to the County Council. They would approve enough projects before, at a point of maybe the $4 to $5 million of projects that would be ready and then approved by the County Council, then and only then would the bond money be actually withdrawn. So it's probably going to take at least a year, maybe even longer, to get enough projects proposed and approved before the bond money is actually withdrawn. We're just trying to see if we can get that bond money approved so that we can proceed in leveraging it and trying to get other grant monies to match the bond money.
Yeah. So at this point, we have not identified any property that the open space bond money would protect?
No, not any specific property, but we know generally that we're using this bond money to be able to save what's available, you know, open lands, historic agricultural lands on the valley floor or in the Wallsburg area or even in the Jordanelle areas. It will depend on willing private property owners.
And do you see that the county would only be buying conservation easements, again, keeping the property within the property owner's hands, but pulling off the development rights? Or do you see the county actually buying land?
No, we're not actually buying land. That's the most expensive way to use the bond money. We want to be as thrifty as possible with the bond money. Our goal on the Open Lands Board is to leverage the bond money 2 to 3 times, and we can do that if we only purchase conservation easements. Yes, conservation easements mean that the private property owner would sell their development rights and receive the bond money and the matching grant monies for selling their development rights. And then they, as private property owners, keep control of the land and keep it in its current agricultural use or open space use. To us, this is the way we can leverage the monies the most. So we don't have specific lands yet, but we know the push would be to work with private property owners, especially in the Northfields or other historic agricultural areas in the valley.
So who decides how that's spent? Ultimately, you said the Wasatch County Council, but is it going to be your committee who makes those recommendations?
We will vet the applications that come to us. We will make sure that they meet not only our Open Lands Board criteria, but the IRS criteria and other nationally certified land organizations criteria in order to get those matching grants. So lots of criteria, lots of legal documentation and understanding that has to happen. We on the board will present it to the County Council. The County Council will then be able to analyze all of the open space projects that come to them and approve that.
So how much is this going to cost if, in fact, voters approve it?
Okay. The costs that have been generated by the Wasatch County Bond Council at this point show that, you know, when the bond is actually withdrawn, right, for the total $10 million, and it won't be drawn in a $10 million, you know, bunch at that right up front, right? It's going to be done in increments as these projects are approved. But anyway, for the total cost, when that $10 million is totally withdrawn, if you have an average primary home of $300,000, and that's our average residential home in the valley right now, $300,000 property tax valuation, it will cost you almost $20 a year for the 30 years. If you have a secondary home or a commercial business valued again at that average value, $300,000, then it would be double that, okay, the $38 a year. If you have a $500,000 primary home, it's going to cost $33 a year for the total $10 million, but it's going to take several years to get to that $10 million bond withdrawal. If you have a $500,000 commercial or secondary home property tax valuation, then it would be that $66 a year for this bond cost. How does that?
Yeah. Real quick, opponents have said that Wasatch County residents have plenty of state and federal lands available for citizens to access just within a few minutes' drive. Why should county citizens spend money on this bond?
Oh, that's a very good question, because this is going to be up to the voters. Do the voters want to directly preserve open space on the valley floor or around existing cities, right? Do we want to preserve that on the valley floor? Yes, we have beautiful open space in our mountains. We love that. This is why we live here. But I think another reason we live here is because we want the open space on the valley floor. We love the fields. We love our historical agriculture, our historical open space in the North Fields, the South Fields, in Wallsburg, up at Jordanelle. So now do the voters want to directly preserve open space on the valley floor, or just expect farmers to continue to do it without any, without any help? This bond gives the farmers another option besides selling to developers. If voters realize the thousands of homes that have been approved in our valley that aren't built yet, but have been approved to be built, I know they'll seriously consider how to preserve the open space in the valley.
All right. I need to leave it there. Again, we'll be talking with somebody against the bond during the local news hour next week. We appreciate your time, Heidi. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a good day, everyone.